I hear what you're saying, and I follow your arguments, but you're wrong. Here's Why by Ian Wolfe.
Nerd Night Sydney is held every month in the Cafe Lounge. Dr. Peter Jonasson is a lecturer in personality and individual differences from the University of Western Sydney. He spoke about the evolutionary functions of the different kinds of sexual relationships people choose to have, from casual to committed. He hung around after the gig, and we went outside the noisy club to speak about the behavioural ecology of sexual relationships.
I would say that what I'm suggesting is that relationships, the types of relationships that people engage in are expressions of competing evolutionary interests between the sexes and the psychological needs that they need to satisfy, in part as a function of both society and from biological evolution. Types of relationships are not fixed categories, right? So everyone's marriage is a little bit different. Everyone's, even one night stand is a little bit different, although maybe less different because there's less time to differentiate it. What's probably more likely is that the categories we use are just convenient fictions in the logical, positivistic kind of way that allow us to talk about these things. So I might say one night stand, and you can tick off in your box, okay, I kind of get what he's talking about. And what my study was trying to do in this case was say, let's have a consensus about what these relationships are. And the way I was defining what they are was based on people's perceived functions that they derive. And those functions, at least in this study, not that there aren't many functions that people get out of relationships, I stuck with four, which was socio-emotional support, sexual gratification, a trial run, as in like you're testing out the waters, and placeholder, as in kind of biding your time until something better comes along. Yeah, these are not necessarily deep evolutionary needs themselves. They're psychological needs. And the point I'm trying to make is that instead of taking an evolutionary perspective, which tends to have a negative connotation in terms of, say, genetic determinism and things like that, I'm suggesting that behavioral ecology, which is much more sensitive to environmental parameters and conditions, maybe this is what drives these relationships. So maybe if I'm in a society where I don't have access to a lot of high-quality mates, instead of committing to one, maybe I have a series of temporary affairs that you might call friends with benefits until maybe I find one that's good enough to settle down with. And it does kind of describe what we do already. As much as we pair up in long-term relationships, like 99% of our relationships are temporary. We even if we date for 5 or 10 years, it ends at some point. And even the ones that don't end, they end in death, so they're kind of in still some ways temporary. There's this insistence on carving up things cleanly, because that's a very simple way of thinking. And my study is trying to say, no, it's not clean. It's extremely messy. And it's messy because men have interests in the mating market, women have interest in the mating market. Indeed, and if there's other factors like parents might have interest, children might have interest. So it is a mess, to say the least.
Yeah, and with those different interests, you were talking about variety of partners
mm-hmm.
as being a difference. What was the evolutionary position behind that?
So the idea behind sexual variety comes from a really good study by my friend David Schmidt. And what he's able to show with enormous sample sizes from something like 56 different countries is that wherever you go, if you ask men and women how many sex partners they would like, say tomorrow, a month, a week, 3 years, a year, a lifetime, the growth curve for men goes up exponentially quicker than the growth curve for women. And we're talking about 18, 19-year-olds here, right? We're not talking about 35-year-olds or 50-year-olds. The idea here is that men derive greater reproductive success by a sexual variety approach, right? More partners meant more potential babies, but more partners for women doesn't mean more potential babies. Every partner she has, she could have a baby with. So there are different evolutionary functions for casual sex. And that's one of the hardest things that people have with the evolutionary psychology models, is that you have to take into consideration the short-term and the long-term distinction. And in the short term, that's when men and women differ the most. But in the long term, we're basically the same. We do converge. That's when the girl and I aren't at odds in our mating efforts. We're actually cooperating now. But in the short term, we're not cooperating. I want quick, low investment sex, cost me very little money, and be able to get it done and get over with. Whereas she's a little bit hesitant about that because she might get pregnant. Now, she might not get pregnant today because of birth control and condoms. But that's not where our psychology is shaped from. The adaptive biases in our brain come from times when there were no condoms and there was no birth control. And we have to We have to avoid the bias of what's called presentism, right? This is not how it always was. This is a really weird life we're living in with buildings and cars. This is not how it is, how our brains were shaped and in the environments under which our brains were shaped.
And in fact, the contraceptive pill, do you think that could have an effect on future evolution as people choose not to have children and take the pill, or choose not to have the pill and have children?
Well, if what it does is it changes frequencies of genes, as in some people are having lots of babies and other people aren't, in the long run, it could have that effect. But we live in a society where babies are extremely protected. So even if I only have one child, and someone else has five children, while that person has, five times as many children as I do, I still have my genes going to the next generation. So the natural selective forces in modern society, at least, are extremely muted, because there's babies. Just 100 years ago, something like 75% of babies died before the year of one. And this is something we easily forget, because we live in a world where babies just live. It's nothing. So today, because of that lessened infant mortality problem, basically everyone has a baby. And what you then get is suppression of the selective forces. And you may actually get, in my mind, and people like Richard Dawkins and Steve Jones as well, you have stagnation of biological evolution. And what you really have is, what you have then is cultural evolution that takes over. And so the idea of all these sci-fi movies, right? So if the Earth falls apart, we don't change what we do here. We move to Mars and we terraform Mars and these types of things. We will whatever we have at this moment is what we're gonna stick with. It's like the principle of first in, right? So this is what we got now, and we're gonna stick with this as long as we can. And we're gonna change society and change the environment to fit this body we have, as opposed to change the body, which takes way longer, and people will die, of course. And that's why people won't do it. So there's this, the emotionality of letting just people die out. Therefore natural selection has been muted. Not that we should let people die, but that's where natural selection kind of falls down a bit, because we're able to artificially prop up, say, deleterious mutations in the genome.
So there's several directions I mentioned going from here. One is that, isn't there evidence that there's been some rapid evolution in the last 1,000 years or so in some populations?
There has been. But the question is, this is a debatable point. And the reason is what type of evolution are you talking about, right? So you could have microevolution and you could have macroevolution. And what it seems that what's been going on the last 1,000 years, and maybe even more than that, is microevolution. So some individuals, say, like, have developed the ability to process the milk of cows, right? This is an adaptation in certain groups. So in China, you get very little ability to process milk, but in people who lived in the Fertile Crescent and places like that, where people were drinking cow's milk, for instance, those who developed the ability to produce lactase, were able to digest lactose and survive better. But it doesn't mean our species is changing, which is what macroevolution is about. And it's kind of like what you see with elephants. So people are hunting elephants and chopping off their tusks. And now some elephants are being born, guess what, without tusks. There's being a selection pressure imposed by humans on elephants to not have tusks. But the species itself may or may not be changing, right? So microevolution has to start first, and if it gets a foothold, then you might get a macroevolutionary change. But I don't see any evidence for macroevolutionary changes in people, but definitely microevolutionary changes. And the other one, of course, which is often confused with adaptations, is just acclimatization, our ability to adapt in a non-evolutionary sense to our local conditions. And we are extremely adaptable as an organism. I mean, we might be the most adaptable organism, and we have colonized every continent on the planet, and most other animals haven't. The only animals that have come close to that are dogs, because of their relationship with us, and the second most kind of widely spread primate are the macaques.
And another issue you talked about was that women had more control over sexual relationships.
Mm. So this is, as people easily get, I don't know if I say offended, but they don't feel that they have power because they've had bad experiences. But we have to take ourselves out of the N equals one problem and say, okay, on average, who really decides when sex occurs in a relationship? And if in any relationship, the guy is like usually pushing the issue, and the woman is usually like, well, no, maybe not yet. Now, of course, there are situations where women are pushing the issue, but if you take 200 people or 200 couples, you're going to find that it was the man who wanted sex on average earlier than the woman wanted sex. And because women have the more valuable commodity, they're able to dictate those terms better. There's the studies are every which way you slice it, women are less willing. So, for instance, one study asks, like, if as a guy, like, I go up to every woman I see right now and I just say, will you have sex with me? Will you go home? Or will you go home with me? Or will you go on a date with me? And men are basically get 100% no's to the will you have sex with me question. But something like 75% of men say yes to this to the sex question, right?
Yes.
So this is a asymmetry in short-term mating, right? But when you ask, will you on a date with me, the sex has now converged because now you're back to the long-term thing. So if you ask... You ask the woman, would you want to date with me? Well, that's not this competitive problem anymore. Now, oh, I'd like to be engaged in something more meaningful, something cooperative with you, as opposed to, I want to extract immediate vagina, basically, out of you. It's an often mistaken dichotomy that people make about things being socially conditioned and things being, say, genetically determined. And if we know anything from the biological, the non-human biological literature, that it's always both things at the same time working in tandem. But what's more interesting is that your ability to understand the function of society and social forces is actually itself an evolutionary thing. Society evolved itself. And you can use really strict things as simply as like the variability in sexual success, like how the variance in the number of sex partners in men and women. And this predicts an amazing amount of things cross-culturally. There's often the idea that in liberal societies that these gender norms, these sex norms go away. It turns out that in more liberal societies, they're stronger. That in places like Norway and Sweden, like sex differences in sexual behavior are actually stronger than they are in, say, more oppressive societies. Because what the oppressive societies do is they don't necessarily as much control women's sexuality, which they do, of course, but they suppress men's sexuality too. And that's what forces them close together. When men are free to do what they want, the differences become tremendous. So in Sweden, you find huge differences. And there's a whole culture built up in Sweden, at least, around the single mother phenomenon. And it's their social system and their welfare system all supports that. It's there's no expectation of marriage in kind of in that system. So when we have these questions, we need to be much more critical and focus on the data as opposed to what we wish to be true. And this is a point that you get really strongly from Richard Dawkins, right? That you wishful thinking doesn't solve the problem, right? It's what is reality. You can want something to be so, but it doesn't make it so.
And if people want to look for further information on your research, where should they look online?
I have a website. It's www, as most are. Peter Jonasson, my last name is spelled JONASON.com.
Terrific. Well, Peter Jonasson, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Peter Jonasson, lecturer at the University of Western Sydney, talking about sexual behaviour and evolution. You can find out more about his work at www.peterjonasson.com. You can find out more about Nerd Night Sydney at sydney.nerdnite.com.
If you'd like to hear more stories, then check the website www.hearswhy.tk and follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe.